Understanding how world wars begin and how they end. We need to recognize that countries are manipulated or even coerced into catastrophic conflicts. We need to learn from history. We need to learn how globalist conspiracy and propaganda, misdirection and manipulation have stampeded societies into death, destruction and devastation. It's happened before, it's happening right now, resulting in further erosion of freedoms and centralization of political and economic power. That's a result of these great global catastrophes. 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2 says, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you." The assassination of Sarajevo was the spark that led to the First World War. 28th of June marks the 108th anniversary of the assassinations which sparked the First World War. On the 28th of June 1914, the heir to the throne of the Austria-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his wife, Sophie, were assassinated in Sarajevo in Bosnia. Considering the catastrophic consequences, it is remarkable how little is generally known about that fateful day and what led up to it. Security personnel and bodyguards can learn no end of lessons of what not to do from the catalogue of security failings on that day. Sarajevo was volatile and violent. First of all, a scheduled visit of Archduke Franz Ferdinand to Bosnia was published as early as March. Sarajevo was a volatile, cosmopolitan, half-oriental community of 42,000 people. For hundreds of years, Sarajevo had been under Ottoman Turkish Muslim rule. The Austrians had liberated Bosnia and Herzegovina from the Ottoman Turkish Empire in 1878, not that long before. In 1908, the provinces of Bosnia and Herzegovina were incorporated formally into the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The date chosen for the state visit of Archduke Franz Ferdinand to Sarajevo was a date of painful historic significance for the Serbs. It was the anniversary of the disastrous defeat on the 28th of June 1389 at the hands of the Ottoman Turks at Kosovo, one of the greatest national catastrophes in the history. Despite Austria playing the leading role in liberating the Balkans from the Turks, from centuries of Ottoman Turkish occupation, and the Ottoman Empire at one stage stretched all the way up to the gates of Vienna and actually conquered Budapest and Hungary, and the Ottoman Turks controlled this whole area for centuries. The neighboring country of Serbia was intensely hostile to Austria, even though it owed its freedom to them. And Serbia wanted to greatly expand its territory to include all the Slavs of the Balkans, including Bosnia and Herzegovina, into Serbia. Now, the Balkan Peninsula was a scene of horrific wars in 1912 to 1913 in particular, and that's just before the state. Serbia was a monarchy, and having tasted victory against the Turks in the Balkan War of 1912, they deluded themselves that they were a great power, able to even take on the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But they'd only won against the Turks because of the help of Austria anyway. The head of Serbian military intelligence, Colonel Dragutin Dimitrijev, known by his codename Apis, which is the Egyptian bull god, like the one that they worship with the golden calf, he also controlled the Black Hand, an international terrorist group run by Major Vojin Tankosovic. It was this group which provided the young Bosnians, including Gavrilo Princip, with 4 Browning semi-automatic pistols, 6 bombs and cyanide capsules to match. This was in May 1914. Princip received some training in pistol target practice in the Central Park in Belgrade, capital of Serbia. Kind of hard to imagine people doing target practice in the Central Park, but that was normal then, apparently. Colonel Dragutin Dimitrijev was described as a revolutionary fanatic, pale, bald, heavy, enigmatic, like a giant Mongolian. Dragutin never married. He was devoted to the movement of Serb nationalism and international terrorism. He required his revolutionaries to undergo a hooded initiation ritual, which includes seal engraved with skull and crossbones, a dagger, a bomb, and poison. In fact, with hindsight, it would seem they were probably Sabbateans. Murder had been his business since his involvement in the 1903 assassination of King Alexander and Queen Draga of Serbia. King Alexander of Serbia and Queen were both murdered in their palace bedroom by a group of Serbian army officers, which included Dragutin. And they were so callously treated, they were thrown literally from the balcony onto the ground and displayed publicly, with these revolutionaries posing in the bedroom where they had committed the murder. So this is the kind of country Serbia was, and the kind of people that were organizing this rogue state. Hardly a democracy. Serbia was described by many as a rogue state whose rulers were intimately involved in international terrorism. The evidence is overwhelming that the young Serbian terrorists who murdered Archduke Franz Ferdinand received their weapons from the Serbian military and the basic training in Belgrade Park. The Serbian Prime Minister, Pasek, informed the cabinet of Serbia at the end of May that the assassins were on their way to Sarajevo to kill Franz Ferdinand more than a month ahead. Serbian state documents include details about the movements of the assassins and of the bombs and the pistols in their luggage, which all bore the Serbian military stamp. The Interior Ministry in Belgrade was fully briefed on all aspects of their mission, yet no warning was forwarded to the Austrian authorities of the planned assassination. From the Austrian side, the lack of rudimentary security arrangements on the tragic day is astounding. Acts of terrorism in and from the Balkans were a clear and present danger. British newspapers published cartoons of Serbian anarchists asking one another, "What time is it by your bomb?" As Archduke Franz Ferdinand left his estate 23rd of June 1914 to travel by train to Bosnia, he commented, "Our journey starts. Down there they will throw bombs at us." Which is no jokes, they did. The Emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Franz Joseph, had lost his wife, the Empress Elizabeth, who had been murdered by an anarchist. Queen or Empress Elizabeth, married to Emperor Franz Ferdinand of Austria, was assassinated while attempting to board a ship in Geneva. So even the Empress of Austria had been successfully targeted by an anarchist, by a revolutionary terrorist, as she was boarding a steamer to Geneva at the time in Switzerland. 25-year-old anarchist Luigi Lucchini plunged an ice pick into her heart. And you can see him actually smiling as he's taken away by the police. "I'm an anarchist by conviction. I came to Geneva to kill a sovereign with object of giving an example. It did not matter to me who the sovereign was whom I should kill." That's the mentality of these anarchists at the time. And that's the ice pick he used. This is how arrogantly he posed. And Austria had lost its empress to these kind of assassins. In 1908, a 20-year-old Slav student assassinated Count Potocki, the governor of Galicia, which is a province of Austria. At the trial of an American-born Croat who had fired at a member of the royal family, the judge asked if he thought killing people was justified. The man responded, "In this case, it is. It is the general opinion in America, and behind me are 500,000 American Croats." In 1906, an anarchist bombed the wedding procession of King Alfonso XIII of Spain. King Alfonso was marrying a granddaughter of Queen Victoria. Fortunately, they failed, and she had a large family. In June 1908, a young Bosnian, Bogdan Zerichik, failed in his attempt to assassinate the emperor himself in Mostar. Later, he traveled to Sarajevo and fired at General Marijan Verasenin. It's alleged that the Black Hand of Serbia had provided his revolver. In June 1912, the governor of Croatia was fired upon in Zagreb. Although the governor was missed, a member of his administration was wounded. In March 1914, the vicar general of Transylvania was killed by a time bomb sent to the post from Romania. Numerous conspiracies to assassinate officials were detected and prevented by the Austrian police. Interestingly enough, Gavrilo Princip was known by the Austrian police to be a potential threat. Yet, when the general Oskar Potiorek, the governor of Bosnia, was warned of the threat from the young Bosnians, he only laughed. The officials at Sarajevo spent more energy discussing dinner menus and the correct temperature at which to serve the wines than issues of security. So on 28th of June 1914, a date of intense significance for the Serbians, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand set out in the uniform of a cavalry general. Blue tunic, gold collar, three silver stars, black trousers, red stripes. His wife Sophie wore a white hat with a veil, long white silk dress, red and white fabric roses tucked into a red sash. On the morning of 28 June, in accordance with the published schedule, the motorcade left Sarajevo railway station. Even had the map of the routes in the newspapers so that the people could line the streets. But of course, that also helps assassins immensely. Shortly before reaching its first scheduled stop, a bomb was thrown by Nedeljko Cabrinovic, and it struck the car of Franz Ferdinand, but was deflected before it exploded behind the vehicle, wounding two bystanders. As Cabrinovic was arrested and led away, he loudly shouted, "I am a Serbian hero." Well, what's heroic about throwing a bomb at a man and his wife in an open vehicle? The other conspirators lost their nerve and failed to use their weapons, even though they were all standing close by. During the attack, the Archduke continued with his published schedule. Now, normally these days, once there's an attempt on someone, they cancel the rest of the schedule. But no, not on this occasion. He met the Governor General, where he watched two local girls perform a folklore dance in this town, Sarajevo, and crossing this bridge. This is the town where history changed dramatically, along with the Apple Way. And these are all pictures from 28th of June, 1914, as Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie leave the town hall and meeting the different people at the different events on that day. Everything decorated for welcoming of the prince. He went on to visit the hospital where those wounded by the bomb were being treated, and these pictures taken actually immediately before the assassination, driving in town. This is a recreation for a film on Sarajevo, the kind of vehicle and people lining the streets with flags. Upon leaving the town hall, the driver took a wrong turn, turning left after crossing the bridge. This bridge right over here. And crossed over this bridge and instead of turning left, got into the wrong road. And the driver was told to stop and turn back, and the car had no reverse, cars did not have reverse gears at that stage. It had to be pushed backwards in neutral, back into Apple Way. And this is the spot where the assassination happened, or as I put here, the place of the catastrophe. It was at this point that Gravello Princip walked up to the open car and fired at Franz and Sophie Ferdinand at point blank range. And all of this could have been avoided if they'd just taken rudimentary security procedures. Again, it's a wrong turn, wrong place, all this sort of thing that led to this. And this is the actual pistol that was used by this terrorist, issued by the Serbian military. The last words of Archduke were, "Sophie, Sophie, do not die, stay alive for our children." And this is still on display, the tunic that was bloodstained at the time of the Archduke, murdered while driving through the streets of Sarajevo. Serbian student assassinates Archduke and his Duchess. This is in Washington Post, although unfortunately in America there was a lot of sympathy for the murderers. The American public had a general attitude that monarchies were bad and assassinations and revolutions were good, and so there was a lot of sympathy for the terrorists, as you will see. They were survived by their daughter and two sons. 28th of June 1914 was Franz and Sophie Ferdinand's 14th wedding anniversary. The district judge, Leo Pfeffer, commented on Princip, "It is difficult to imagine that so frail-looking an individual could have committed so serious a deed." In fact, when Princip had volunteered to fight for Serbia in the First Balkan War in 1912, he was rejected as being too small. At his first interrogation by the police in Sarajevo, Princip had declared that throughout his life, wherever he went, people took him for a weakling and he wanted to prove them wrong, at great cost to everyone else. Within days, all the conspirators were in custody, with the exception of the Muslim, Mehmet, who escaped to Montenegro. As Austria did not execute adolescents, in fact, they didn't execute anyone under 20. He was either 17 or 18 years old at the time. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison, died of natural causes, tuberculosis, in April 1918. But before he died, Princip was asked by the prison psychiatrist if he had any regrets that his deed had sparked a world war and the deaths of millions. Princip made it clear he had no regrets. And these people are pathological. It's just staggering to think of the mindset behind assassins like that. Interestingly, Princip had killed the one man in the Austrian Empire who was committed to averting war with either Serbia or Russia. Franz Ferdinand had been the one member of the Austrian royal family who had good relations with the Russians. Franz Ferdinand was on record declaring, "I shall never lead a war against Russia. I shall make sacrifices to avoid it. A war between Austria and Russia would end either with the overthrow of the Romanovs or the overthrow of the Habsburgs, or perhaps the overthrow of both." Prophetic words. He once wrote to the foreign minister, "Let us not play Balkan warriors ourselves. Let us not stoop to this hooliganism. Let us stay aloof and watch the scum bash in each other's skulls," because Balkan wars and terrorism were normal. So let's not lower ourselves to their level. "It would be unforgivable, insane," he said, "to start something that would pit us against Russia." Franz Ferdinand's moderate stand was clearly seen by how, despite all the threats, he chose to make a state visit to one of the most volatile cities in one of the most unstable parts of Europe, in an open car with almost no security. However, it's a practice of terrorists to assassinate moderates, to provoke reaction. They want to provoke reaction. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. This is the Marxist dialectic. The British ambassador in Germany declared that the assassinations were a dreadful act, of which the political consequences are incalculable, which is true. In St. Petersburg, Russia, journalists dismissed the assassinations as a characteristic bit of Balkan savagery. Almost every country in Europe had suffered the effects of assassinations by communist revolutionary anarchists, like Princip, and there was general sympathy for Austria and disgust for Serbia's obvious role across the board. And the whole world paid attention as the bodies of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie were transported back to Vienna for the state funeral. Yet, just over a month later, most of Europe would mobilize against Austria's attempts to deal with the Serbian terrorist threat, which makes no sense whatsoever. Admiral Tirpitz of Germany said this war is really the greatest lunacy ever committed by the white races. So this is auto-genocide. We are going to destroy our people. We're going to go from leadership of the world to being subservient, which is what happened. Kaiser Wilhelm II said it is not I who bears the responsibility for the disaster which now threatens the entire civilized world. I mean, remember, in 1914, Christians in Europe ruled the world, with the exception of Japan, the Ottoman Empire, which was collapsing, and China, which was very weak. Europe ruled the rest of the world. Either the superpowers, which were Protestant, like Germany, America, and Britain, or Catholic in the case of France and Austria, Italy, Spain, Portugal, or Orthodox in the case of Russia. And yet they managed to wipe one another out by the millions. Although he had given the Austrian support to act against Serbia, when the Austrian Archduke was murdered by the Serb terrorist on June the 28th of 1914, by the last days of July, there was no monarch in Europe trying more desperately to stop Europe's plunge to war than Kaiser Wilhelm II, who gets the blame for the war. Franz Ferdinand remembered in postage stamps. America puts out this poster, "Save Serbia, our ally. Send contributions to Serbian Relief Committee of America." The sympathy in America was so great for Serbia that President Woodrow Wilson, every year on the 28th of June, would raise the Serbian flag at the White House on the anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. America had a very revolutionary bent, and Woodrow Wilson was a particular globalist who could see the benefit of collapsing Europe in order to bring about a new world order. In fact, these characters, Woodrow Wilson and Clemenceau of France and Lloyd George of Britain, they chose the 28th of June 1919 to force Germany to sign the Versailles Treaty, on the anniversary of the assassination, the fifth anniversary assassination of Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie, they made that the date for the Versailles Treaty, just showing the vindictive pro-terrorist mentality of these globalists like Woodrow Wilson. Proverbs 26 verse 17 says, "He who passes by and meddles in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a dog by the ears." You grab a dog by the ears, you're going to get bitten in the face. It's not a clever thing to do. And what on earth was America, Britain, France, or anyone else doing, getting in the way of Austria and Serbia's quarrel? What did it have to do with the British Empire? "And then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more." So Revelation 20 lets us know that right now Satan is deceiving nations. The day will come and God will send an angel to bind Satan that he might deceive the nations no more. But right now, nations are being deceived. And the first casualty in war is truth. If you need any evidence that what we've been told mostly in the media about the war in Ukraine is mostly lies, you just have to study the history of the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and all the other wars, the Gulf War, weapons of mass destruction, Iraq, I mean, all this sort of thing. The lies, lies, lies. There's no end of lies. When it comes to war, politicians murder the truth. As my history teacher in Rhodesia remind us, beware the victor's version. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. And there's no such thing as a harmless lie. Distortions of history, deceptions in the media, myths, legends, exaggerations in history textbooks all have serious consequences. 1914 shattered Europe. An entire generation of young men died in brutal trench warfare. No other war changed the map of Europe so dramatically. These are all boundaries that happened immediately after the war. Three great European empires were destroyed by the First World War. The great German Empire, which had been the bulwark protecting Europe from Eastern Mongols and Huns over the centuries. Interesting that the British called them the Huns during the war because they were the ones who protected Europe from the Huns, actually. Huns as in from Hungary, you know, Attila the Hun, that sort of thing. Germany, pinnacle of civilization that could produce such great art and culture, and Handel and Bach, Luther. Germany, who could put on their belt buckles, got them at once, destroyed by the First World War. The Russian Empire, great Christian empire that had civilized and Christianized the whole of Asia, been one of the greatest forces against Ottoman Turkish Empire, destroyed by that empire, by that war, and replaced by the most antichrist, anti-Christian Bolshevik empire in history. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had been the Ostenreich, the Eastern Empire, that had been the bulwark protecting Europe from the Turks for centuries. Austria had held the line to protect Europe from the threat of Turkish invasions for centuries. But they were all wiped out by the First World War. 1914 marked the end of the greatest century of Christian advance and the beginning of what proved to be the worst century of persecution. More Christians have died in the 20th century than have died for their faith in the previous 19 centuries combined. This great legacy of empire degenerated very fast into gas warfare. The first air warfare, trench warfare, mustard gas, you name it. The consequence of the First World War continues to have far-reaching repercussions to this present day. It destroyed a generation. This is one of the biggest man-made holes outside the big hole of Kimberley, created by one single explosion. The British brought coal miners in from Wales. They dug and dug and dug under the German positions and they planted so much explosives, something like 1 million pounds of TNT. And one big explosion, it could be heard from Belgium all the way back into England and vaporized huge area, killed vast amount of people and created massive hole, which today is a dam, man-made lake, created by man-made explosions. They did these all over the place. This was the first era of total mobilization. Russia mobilized 12 million soldiers. Germany mobilized 11 million. France mobilized 8.4 million. Even Great Britain mobilized 8.9 million, of whom a quarter of a million were underage boys who served in the British Army, including one who was discovered to be just 12 years old. I've been to the grave of a 15-year-old buried in British cemetery around Ypres. And they must have known, but they didn't care. They didn't mind. You know, the outrage these days of child soldiers in Africa. Well, Britain had no problem using child soldiers in the First World War. Mountains of them. I mean, a quarter of a million underage soldiers in just in the British ranks. And some of the Australians got involved, and the Indians got involved, and regional South Africans got involved. Average life expectancy in the trenches was about 6 weeks. Italy mobilized 5.6 million, Austria mobilized 7.8 million, America even mobilized 4.3 million, even though they only came in the last year of the war. Of the 60 million European soldiers who were mobilized from 1914 to 1918, over 9 million were killed, 9 million were permanently disabled, crippled, and 15 million were seriously injured. That means, of the 60 million mobilized, more than half were casualties. Contemporaries called it the Great War, because it was literally greater than any war that had been waged before that time. They didn't call it the First World War. They didn't know there'd be a second. They called it the war to end all wars. It was called the Great War. People only started to call it the First World War after the Second World War. In numbers of soldiers involved, in terms of numbers of casualties, in terms of the disastrous consequences, it was the most catastrophic event in the history of European civilization, and I should say in the history of Christian civilization too, because at that time it was almost parallel. Because in 1914, Christian nations ruled virtually the whole world, from Great Britain throughout Europe. With the exception of China, Japan, and the Ottoman Empire, the globe was dominated by Christian powers, as far as Canada, Alaska, and through to New Zealand and Australia. Either Protestant, in the case of Britain, Germany, and the United States, the superpowers, Roman Catholic, as in the case of Austro-Hungarian Empire, the French Empire, Italy, Portugal, and Spain, or Orthodox in the case of the Russian Empire. Europe was overwhelmingly Christian, with the exception of the Ottoman Empire that had a little toehold left in Europe, just on the other side of the Bosphorus. Following the Battle of Waterloo and the conclusion of the French, Napoleonic, and Revolutionary Wars, the Congress of Vienna in 1815 ushered in a century of relative, comparative peace. After 25 years of constant warfare, the next century looked almost like a peaceful century by comparison. There were some odd wars, but they were short and sharp. And this is the result of the 1814 Congress of Vienna, which basically preserved the way the map looked for the next century in Europe. It was also a century of astounding increases in population growth, unprecedented increases of productivity and standards of living, and this is why people lived longer, because of introduction of plumbing, clean water, swift, efficient removal of waste, better medical conditions, better food, industrial revolution, agricultural revolution, people lived longer, and so on. And so suddenly Europe escalated in population to the point that by 1914, 32% of the world's population were European. 32%. It's more like 9% now. Just the Crystal Palace just demonstrates the advances. And the people were into high fashion and all kinds of... And this is what is said often, that one generation must study warfare so that the next generation can study engineering and practical arts, so that the third generation can do arts and music and so on. And it is so, because survival is your first requirement. And then once you have a stable economy, then you can start to diversify. Some people considering the arts and scientific advancements. The 19th century had been a century of incredible achievements, growth, and expansion. By 1914, all the inhabited world had been penetrated and, for the most part, mastered by people who traditionally were known as Christian. And so the great European empires dominated the world in 1914. There was great promise for the future. Christianity came to the beginning of the 20th century on a rising, apparently unstoppable tide. Christianity was gaining spectacular momentum. Just think of the preaching of Charles Spurgeon being published in the newspapers every Monday, his sermons in full. You think of how millions of copies of Spurgeon's sermons were being sold. Over 100 million of his books had been sold by 1914. Just Charles Spurgeon. Then you can talk about D.L. Moody and so many others. Missionaries from Europe were evangelizing and discipling virtually every nation and tribe on the planet. The Protestant faith had far outstripped the Catholic and Orthodox branches. In missionary activity and vitality and initiative, the Protestants were leading the pack. And from being confined almost entirely to northwestern Europe, the British Isles and the narrow strip on the eastern seaboard of North America, with a small outpost of Christians at the Cape of Good Hope, the Protestant faith in the 19th century became a truly international faith, not just in every continent, but in every country. It was also the dominant faith of the most productive, powerful, prosperous nations in both the northern and the southern hemispheres. Amidst irrepressible optimism, many were openly speaking of the beginning of the biblical millennium on earth. At 1910, the world's first missions conference in Edinburgh, 1910, delegates were anticipating the completion of the Great Commission within their generation. They were predicting by 1960, the Great Commission will be fulfilled, the whole world will be evangelized, Islam and Buddhism will be extinct, the whole world will be Protestant by 1960. And that wasn't an unrealistic expectation. If the present trends from the 19th century had continued into the 20th century, that would have been feasible. Had present trends continued, this was a realistic scenario. Nothing could have stopped the positive onward march of Christianity, except that Christians were persuaded to kill one another so enthusiastically and so efficiently with everything from flamethrowers, tanks, poison gas, massed artillery, every kind of warfare that had never been imagined before, from submarine to aerial warfare. The First World War, Europe killed one another with such efficiency it staggers the mind. Nobody in 1910 could have anticipated any of this. The wholesale abandonment of entire nations to communism, one third the world's land surface within a generation in the hands of godless atheistic communists, handing over entire countries to false religions like Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and heathenism, taking over even Britain, where today you've probably got more clairvoyance in France than you have ministers of the gospel. In Britain, you might have more Wiccans and pagans than you have Bible-believing evangelical Christians. Nor would anyone have predicted that the church would retreat from victory to such an extent that some would even be questioning the existence of the devil and the existence of hell, as many church denominations are doing now, or reinterpreting marriage to include what God in the Bible describes as perversion and an abomination. And forget about a day of pride, gay pride. America's in the middle of what they call Gay Pride Month. Month? In fact, statistically, there's only 1.3% of the population are gay. How on earth is it that they get a Pride Month? Bizarre. The Christian era of bold missionary expansion came to an abrupt end as the guns of August 1914 erupted. The great European countries, which had been the heartland of Christendom, the source of most of the world's missionaries, devastated each other's economies, annihilated millions of one another's young men, in what has to be recognized as the most tragic, senseless conflict in history. Before the First World War, Europe had never been more powerful or more self-confident. There was no hint of any possible challenge to its leadership of the civilized world. Nobody, not even America, could have imagined challenging Europe on any military or political or economic level. 1914 marked a far more drastic turning point in world history than 1815, Waterloo, or 1648, Peace of Westphalia, that ended the 30 Years' War, or any of the other watershed events in early history. As the great nations of Europe mobilized for war against themselves, it was said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." The man who said this, the British Foreign Secretary, Edward Grey, was one of the main architects of this war, actually. It doesn't mean that what he said wasn't true. It just is awfully hypocritical. Here's one of the ones who actually designed and crafted the alliance between Britain, Russia, and France, which dragged Britain into this war. Yet even as that was said, it could not have been anticipated how much destruction and dislocation of Christian civilization would come from this disastrous conflict. When lamps of political wisdom or spiritual truth, intellectual and artistic progress, moral foundations, and economic growth were rekindled, they shone far less brightly in the ancient centers of Christian civilization than they had for centuries before. The man in the middle here is Pat Buchanan. He was the speechwriter and strategist for Ronald Reagan. Pat Buchanan wrote what I think is one of the finest books analysing the First and Second World War, called Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. In fact, I've been through this book several times, that's how good it is. And I've preached and taught and lectured on this book and many of its insights quite a lot. He really analyses well, and there's one man who straddled both, who was involved in bringing about the First World War and the Second World War, and that's Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was a warmonger par excellence. He was one of only two members of the British cabinet who supported Britain getting involved in the First World War. And he conspired more than anyone else to get Britain involved in the Second. When Churchill came to power in 1912 as First Lord of the Admiralty, Britain was at its apex of world power, the most unchallenged superpower the world had ever seen, dominating one-fourth of the world's land surface. By the time he finished his political career in the 1950s, Britain was a third-rate country that had suffered the worst catastrophe and loss of empire seen in any country's history. And Churchill, more than any other human being, was responsible for the policies it brought about. And I think Patrick Buchanan is dead right. And he points out that the Churchillian cult we've got today, where every enemy is a new Hitler, you know, Putin, Assad, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, they're all the new Hitler, and you can be the new Churchill. He said this Churchillian cult has led the world into no end of worthless wars, which have killed millions of people for no good reason and left those countries worse off than they were before, which is exactly what Churchill did in each of his cases. And he documents this and points out how Churchill was far from being a Christian. He was a pagan, and he was a homosexual, and he was a anti-Christian pagan in so many ways. In fact, you can see where Churchill stood. I know he's been glamorized by a lot of Christians foolishly, but in his own writings, he writes of when he was going into Afghanistan back in the 1890s. He went with the British into Afghanistan, and he writes, "We went into the village and we killed everyone, man, woman, children, we left nothing alive." And he doesn't write it as a confession, he writes it like, this is good. He says that the worst sound he ever heard in his life, more terrifying than the sound of incoming shells, was the day he was captured by the Boers. That night, as they sat around the campfire, he heard the Boers singing psalms. He said this was more terrifying than the sound of incoming shells, to hear his enemies singing the psalms. And he said, "What type of enemy do we have?" And it just shows you something of what Churchill was. And Churchill, what a war criminal. When he's the one who drew the map of the Middle East, which left the Kurds under the oppression of Turkey and Iran and Iraq. The Kurds, who should have their own country. Something like 45 million Kurds. Why don't they have their own country? He drew the map, gave the boundaries, modern-day boundaries, to Iraq and Kuwait and so on. He was in charge of the colonies at that stage. He dismantled the Ottoman Empire into its present form, which has caused the ongoing wars. And when the Kurds objected, he got them bombed with mustard gas. Shot with camels, bombing them with mustard gas. And the amount of things Churchill got up to, starving millions of Indians, deliberately starving them. He said, there's too many Indians. And he made sure in the Second World War that they deprived them of food so that they would, he said, they breed like rabbits. We've got to, you know, bring the numbers down. And this Churchill, he is the idol of Britain. Just like Lincoln is to America and Lenin was to the Soviet Union and Mandela is to this country and what Mao was to China. He is an idol, and he's, like any idol, needs to be brought down. And I think Pat Buchanan does a brilliant job in this, of showing that this Churchillian cult today of idolizing this disastrous, catastrophic leader has led to no end of sufferings for the 20th century. And I think that's important. So when Margaret Thatcher died, I wrote a eulogy of Margaret Thatcher saying she is the greatest British Prime Minister of the 20th century. And then I waited. Inevitably people said, "But what about Winston Churchill?" And I could write back, "What about Winston Churchill? Margaret Thatcher left Britain stronger, militarily, politically, economically, spiritually, stronger than she found it." Churchill couldn't say that. So who gets a responsibility for the Great War? Well, Because there were monarchs in virtually every country in Europe at the time, it was easy to blame the monarchs. But in fact, they weren't the ones who drove the war. The war was driven by the newspaper editors who whipped up the creatures in the streets, the mobs, to howl and scream for war. The monarchs, in most cases, were the ones trying to put on the brakes and say no. But the monarchs get the blame, and they, of course, got the boot and the axe at the end of it. London Daily Telegraph, in response to an article by Boris Johnson saying that Germany was responsible for the Great War, said Boris Johnson is not a historian. He is to be condemned for ignoring a century of scholarship, showing that Germany was not responsible for the Great War. It is really difficult to believe that this Allied wartime propaganda is still being repeated a century on as gospel, and so cementing into the uneducated minds a travesty of truth. The German diplomatic service, more than anyone else, was desperately trying to avoid a war until the last minute. In fact, Germany was the last country to mobilize, which was universally accepted as a declaration of war upon your neighbors. Even Belgium mobilized before Germany. We should be under no illusions that the Serbs bear the principal responsibility for starting the ball rolling by the organized murder of the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary and his wife. There are some excellent books that have come out on this. A.J.P. Taylor was the first authority I read back when I was a young teenager in Rhodesia. A.J.P. Taylor opened up my eyes to the fact, as Cambridge professor, to the fact that it was not as simple as they were trying to make out. And Richard Milton's book, Best of Enemies, Britain and Germany, Truth and Lies in Two World Wars, also very helpful. And Pat Buchanan's book, very helpful too. There have been other books, like Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War. And Stephen Mitford Goodson, a good friend of the Reformation Society who lectured on this very subject here and has written books on it, A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind, where he shows the banksters, the gangster bank owners who have been having their fingers in the wars of the 20th century. As he says, it actually goes back to Napoleonic Wars, goes back to even Rome, but nevertheless, he certainly sees the bankers running most of the wars in the 20th century. And I think it's a very interesting analysis that he brings to bear. The sinister bankers who pulled the strings behind the scenes and engineered the auto-genocide of Europe were also the same ones who owned many of the companies that made the machine guns and the bullets and the bombs and the factories, the plants, even the gas bombs. These are all gas bombs. You can see all the XXX around them, that these are not normal shells. This is gas bombs. And you can see the way they corrode as well. And the shells and the artillery, vast amounts of artillery, and the railways and so much more, which destroyed the cream of Europe. And the tanks. Britain produced 5,500 tanks, all out of Rothschild factories in the First World War. Interestingly enough, Germany produced 20 tanks in the First World War. Britain produced 5,500, something Germany determined to rectify in the Second World War. And most of these tanks didn't manage to drive more than 2 miles before conking out. Awful waste of money. Didn't achieve much. Now, A.J.P. Taylor publishes this graph on burden of armaments before the First World War, 1914. Now, you can see here that Russia had the most men. That's the number of men, 1.3 million men in the Russian army, and they were spending £520 million in their armaments. Germany had 834,000 men under arms and were paying 340 million for armaments and military budget. Britain had less people under power, under manpower, but was spending more than Germany on their military. That's because of their phenomenal navy, which was greater than several other navies combined. France had about as big an army as Germany and spent as much money on the armaments as Germany did. And so there's no evidence that Germany was militaristic or out of proportion with the rest of Europe. If anything, they were surrounded by enemies. During one battle in Flanders, in Belgium, 5 million artillery shells were fired by the British Royal Artillery in a 3-day period on a 10-mile front. And you can't imagine what this does to hearing. Just for starters, my dad was in the Royal Artillery, and it definitely affected his hearing. he ran 25 pounds in the Second World War, but just look at the amount of wastage, the amount of ordnance, and just the mountains and mountains of metal, and what it did to whole forests. An average of 5 tons of high explosive was placed in every square meter, turning the ground into mud. This is an area with very, what do we call it, a very low water table, or high water table. And it swallowed entire units, cavalry units, artillery of the British and Canadian forces. At Passchendaele, after they pulverized this area and put 5 tons of high explosive every square meter and all the Canadians in, they just disappeared. They lost tens of thousands of men, just disappeared into mud. Horses, cavalry, look, under the mud, gone. Still digging them up now. And Passchendaele, just absolute, you mentioned Passchendaele in Canadian presence, they're still traumatized by what Passchendaele did to their army. And many of their men, once advanced, got killed by friendly fire. The destruction of forests and generations. There are numerous studies that have shown the role of the Freemason bankers and politicians like Lord Nathan Rothschild, whose goal was to bring down Christian civilization. So just take someone like Nathan Rothschild. He's on the British cabinet that declares war. He runs the Bank of England, from which the government borrows the money, which the next 5 generations are going to have to pay off. And then he's the one who runs the companies that have to be paid for the armaments that are going to go and kill other Christians. So how's that for conflict of interest? A previous Nathan Rothschild said, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England to rule the empire on which the sun never sets. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply." War is the greatest debt creator known to man. Although I think they're not trying with pandemics. I think the pandemics are maybe eclipsing war with shutdowns and vaccinations and so on. But generally, historically, war has been... And the people who got filthy rich out of the First World War, the Rothschilds, Morgan, Rockefellers. The cost of the war for Britain alone was £6 million per day. And that's when the British pound was worth a lot more than today. The total cost of the First World War for Britain was $186 billion in 1918 money. Those who control the debt control everything. This is just one of the factories in Coventry. By the way, you wonder why Coventry got bombed in the Second World War? What had the biggest factories of armaments owned by the Rothschilds, by the way. And this is the Freemason symbol. We've had a whole presentation on 1666 and the Sabbatean roots of New World Disorder. And if you want, we've got the Gospel Defense League letter on all that to give you the background of the role of the Sabbateans and the Freemasons and the Illuminati in orchestrating so much of the disastrous wars in this world. But this is just Joseph Rothschild and his children, who ran the banks all over Europe. Well, everywhere except Russia. Russia was the only European power that didn't have a Rothschild bank, which is why the Tsar's family were treated with such savagery. Mayor Rothschild, who took over in 1916 from the Bank of England. And so here you can see some of the Rothschilds who ran the banks in London, Frankfurt, Vienna, Naples, Paris, and later New York as well. All the way down to today. When they speak about Elon Musk being the richest man in the world, think, what happened to the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers? And how can we even accept that? That's a lot of nonsense. How can Elon Musk possibly be richer than the Rothschilds? But anyway, this is just the modern way of they say it often enough and you begin to believe that Elon Musk is the richest man in the world. No, he's not by a long shot. Nothing could have stopped the positive onward march of Christianity worldwide except that Christians were persuaded to kill one another so enthusiastically and so efficiently. The results were devastating. The London Times on the 24th of July 1916 during the Battle of the Somme listed 608 British officer casualties and 5,500 other ranks. This was just one day's casualty list in a four-month battle. 8% of Britain's total population were either killed or wounded. 9% of Germany's total population were either killed or wounded. 11% of France's entire population were casualties. Now, this means an average of 10% of the total population. That's from babes to geriatrics. I mean, all ages. But it meant half of all the soldiers mobilized were casualties. Half. But 10% of the total population. The British Empire lost 908,000 people. Russia lost 1.7 million. France, 1.3 million. Germany lost 1.7 million soldiers killed. not counting crippled. And it's horrific, absolutely. The butcher's bill on the casualty of the Great War. This doesn't include the many hundreds of thousands of civilians who died of starvation due to the naval blockade, or diseases which accounted for 1/3 of all the deaths during the war, or the Spanish flu, which killed more people in the Great War in the year immediately after the war because of vaccinations and bad hygiene. This is one regiment before the war, and the only ones who survived are that regiment at the end of the war. At Ypres Gate, I counted 65 hammers written on the wall. This is just in Belgium. When I went to the British and Commonwealth War records, found on the computers 480 hammers killed fighting for the British Empire in the First World War. 480 just of my own surname. And it's not just the people who died. There were dogs who were helping as medics, war dogs, and the poor horses. They suffered a lot. They were used a lot in the warfare at that stage, which was absolutely tragic. And cemeteries and memorials to the horses and the dogs. And so many died there. Here is a memorial of just horses' hooves and stirrups. And here's a unit of cavalrymen formed up in the shape of a horse's head. War horses are a very hard film to watch, because of just demonstrating what the poor horses went through in the war. And South Africa, somebody sent a springbok up into Flanders, into Belgium, as a South African army mascot. And that's tragic. I just don't know why you'd want to take any poor animal there. I suppose soldiers like to have a mascot, but nobody would want to see an animal subjected to artillery barrages and things like that. And that springbok did not survive. And this is South Africa's war cemetery in France. These South Africans died for France, who would later put sanctions on us and support the terrorists who would be planting bombs in our country. The EFF vandalized this monument in memory of horses who died during the Anglo-Boer War. The purple flowers to remember the animals who died in the war. But even more devastating than the actual numbers of people and animals killed, crippled, or severely injured was the damage to the spiritual life of Europe. Europe went from being a majority church-attending population to a continent where most people did not go to any church. You can see some of the pointlessness of the war when you can see here German and French soldiers helping one another in the middle of a battle. Here you see them trying to pull some poor Frenchman who's drowning in the mud of a bomb crater. And a British prisoner being given a cigarette by a German captor. And these, some of the people who were conscientious objectors, like Seventh-day Adventists who didn't believe they could go and fight, who were put in the stocks and treated like traitors because it was against their conscience to fight. I think every country should respect and have place for conscientious objectors to do non-violent activities. There's non-combatant roles. We always need medics. We always need people involved in many different, whether it's distribution or transport. So it was so unnecessary to treat these conscientious objectors like criminals. In America, they lynched some Amish and Mennonite people for refusing to join up in the war. With so many men mobilized for war, millions of women were mobilized to fill their places in the workplaces and factories and on farms. Now, up till this stage, the average woman was having 8 to 12 children. After this, it went down to 3 or 4, and now it's more like 1.2. So more than 1 million women in Britain alone were mobilized into work previously performed by men, especially in factories. And those women who worked with TNT explosives found their skin turned yellow through toxic jaundice. The mobilizing of millions of women into factories and fields to take the place of men conscripted into war transformed the social order and eroded the stability of the family, and a generation of children were deprived of the influence of both mother and father at home. Bad enough the father's away, but now the mother's away too. No wonder the 20s were a time of gangsters and speakeasies and flappers, and so much degeneracy came out of it because those children knew no discipline. They didn't have father or mother at home. The secularization of Europe and the breakaway of moral standards coincided with the great resurgence of revolutionary fervor. Marxist communism filled the vacuum left by the collapse of the Russian Empire and by the emergence of many new countries in Eastern Europe in the place of the Austrian Empire. Along with a spiritual decline in Europe came the decline of Western Europe on the world scene. These are the unexpected, inevitable consequences of mobilizing for war. The 19th century had seen such staggering growth in numbers, productivity, military power and wealth, you would have expected Europe to have continued to dominate the globe for centuries to come. For over 1,000 years, Europe had been Christendom, the heartland, the stronghold of Christian civilization. The optimism which had prevailed in the 19th century, the greatest century of missions, gave way to profound pessimism after the First World War. The de-Christianization and the secularization of Europe was not only unprecedented in speed and scope, but it would have been unthinkable before the First World War. Nobody could have seen it coming. For over 1,000 years, Christianity had been Christendom, the heartland, the stronghold of Christian civilization. And the optimism now went to pessimism. People went from being mostly post-millennial to mostly pre-millennial. The de-Christianization, the secularization of Europe was devastating. Nobody could have imagined this coming before. And so, in Europe, the traditional stronghold of the Christian faith, the proportion of those who call themselves Christians declined. The percentage of those who regularly attended church services fell off even more drastically. While Protestants were increasing in Africa, North and South America and Asia, the numbers of Christians in Europe sharply declined. Operation World has shown that in the 20th century, only Europe has had a decrease in the percentage of Christians. Every other continent has had an increase in the percentage of Christians. It's notable that social Darwinism had become popular amongst most of the governments of Europe. So what caused the cataclysm? Evolutionism was one. This thinking of social Darwinism emphasized the importance of armed struggle between nations as healthy and necessary for evolution progress. You see, preservation of favored nation, races. This is Charles Darwin's teaching. The origin of species and the preservation of favored race through natural selection, which means violence brings about good things. Evolution leads to revolution, said Stalin, which is quite true. What else caused the First World War? Entangling alliances. Now, just think of the result of entangling alliances right now, which is endangering all of Northern Europe and Northern Hemisphere in a world war. There were entangling alliances in 1914. The Entente Cordiale between France and Russia, between Britain and France, and between Britain and Russia, formed the Triple Entente. And the question is, why did Great Britain form an alliance with their traditional enemies, the French and the Russians, against their traditional allies, the Germans? My father used to say, I can't believe we wasted our time fighting for the French twice. He had the attitude, typical British attitude, that the French were our traditional enemies, which they always had been in British history. Somebody brought out a history book a while ago, 1,000 years of British history, 1,000 years of irritating the French and other British history, and that's not too much of a joke. But then, how is it that the British, who are Protestants, allied with the French atheistic revolutionaries from Catholic background and the Russian Orthodox, who'd been their traditional enemies, against their traditional allies, the Germans, especially considering the entire British royal family are German? How did a terrorist act in Sarajevo sever the special relationship between Britain and Germany, which had endured for centuries? It was understandable that Austria was going to deal with their troublesome neighbours, Serbia, which had been encouraging and hosting revolutionaries and terrorists against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. However, as Austria presented its ultimatum to Serbia, the Russian Empire mobilized against Austria. And this led to Germany mobilizing in support of its Austrian ally against Russia. And the French, who were allied to the Russian Empire, and were spoiling for a fight to reverse the humiliating military defeat that suffered at the hands of Germany in 1870, when Louis Napoleon had declared war on Germany. We understand that. But strangely, King Edward VII had allied Britain to France and Russia, probably out of spite for his Christian evangelical parents, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. Edward VII was a real nasty pagan who, probably out of his love for the French prostitutes in the brothels of Paris, got Britain allied with the French, which is insane. And Britain ended up on the side of its traditional enemies, France and Russia, against its traditionally closest allies, Germany. Which, before 1914, Britain and Germany had never fought against one another. They'd always fought on the same side, such as at Waterloo. Most of the 60 million soldiers involved in the Great War would have been unable to explain what they were actually fighting for. That they were pawns in a diplomatic power game manipulated by unseen conspirators behind the scenes would have been the furthest thing from most of their minds. They wouldn't have even thought of the bankers. Most of them probably didn't even know the name of Rothschild. From the British point of view, involvement in the First World War is an even greater mystery. There were no British interests at stake. Had Britain stayed out of the European conflict, it wouldn't have been a world war. It would have just been a European war. East European war, that. So what would have happened if Britain had stayed out of the conflict? First of all, Britain would have kept her empire. Britain would still be the greatest power in the world, probably to this day, controlling huge amounts of the world. Secondly, Germany would have been able to defeat both France and Russia in a matter of months, which they effectively did. The German army was, without doubt, the best in the world at that time, just as the Royal Navy was the best navy in the world at that time. And new treaties would have been signed, and some borders may have been adjusted, but no cataclysmic collapse of empires would have occurred. It would have been over in a couple of months. The death toll would have been a fraction of what it became. America would not have been dragged into war. Nor would Rhodesia, South Africa, Australia and so on. These are Rhodesian soldiers marching off to war, mobilizing for the First World War. Why? What did it have to do with us? Europe would have remained the most powerful industrial, political, military force in the world if Britain had just stayed out of the First World War. As Ian Smith said, it would have been better off if we had stayed out of it. It would have been better off if we had lost the First World War. Europe and Africa would still be strong. But because we took the wrong side, the Soviet Union came to power, communist threat threatened the entire world, and we lost everything all over Africa. The constitutional monarchies in Central and Eastern Europe would have endured and continued to reform. There would have been no power vacuum into which communism would have been born. There obviously would have been no Second World War either, which was just a continuation of the First. All in all, the world would be a far better and different place if Britain and America had stayed out of the First World War, which wouldn't have been a world war at all. It would have just been a short, sharp war between Austria, Serbia, France, and Russia. That's it. And that would have been over fairly quickly. Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator who was first to solo fly across the Atlantic, said, "A bond with Europe is a bond of race and not of political ideology. As the European race we must preserve, political progress will follow. Racial strength is vital, politics a luxury. If the white race is ever seriously threatened, it may be time for us to take our part in its protection, to fight side by side with the English, French and Germans, and not with one against the other for our mutual destruction." Well, you can be sure he was hated in America for saying that. Major General Smedley Butler is the most decorated Marine in American history. He said there's only two things we should fight for. One is the defense of our homes, the other is for the Bill of Rights. War for any other reason is simply a racket. And he wrote the book, War is a Racket, Smedley Butler. And he became a protester against America's involvement in the First and the Second World War. He had been involved in a whole lot of other wars before that, and he discovered they were just doing this for oil cartels and bankers, and he just got sick of it, that how many Marines they lost fighting for no good reason except some economic and political machinations. So, why did Britain get involved in the First World War? The Liberals had been in power in the House of Commons since 1906. Their electoral support was withering away, Herbert Askew's government was on the verge of collapse, and it was clear that they went to war partly to keep the Conservative Party from ousting them from the imminent elections. To those who ask, can it be possible that any political leaders could be so small-minded as to jeopardize the lives of millions and the good of their nation merely to keep their political party in power? Recent history continues to confirm that just such corrupt, small-minded pettiness continues to predominate amongst many who meant to be civil servants. Why did South Africa declare economic suicide or mass murder with the lockdowns? Well, we know that Cyril Ramaphosa was under great pressure within his own party and probably wouldn't have stayed in power but for the lockdowns the last 2 years, which suspended Parliament. Why did America and Britain do all these things? Well, you can see there's a lot of political reasons why they'd want to do them too. There's a lot of things that are done, even wars declared and missiles launched and countries destroyed, simply to keep certain politicians in power and to distract the electorate. Never before had so much of mankind been engaged simultaneously in war. Never before had mankind amassed such large armies or produced such weapons which worked wholesale destruction on such a gigantic scale. What was the effects in Germany? The Protestant faith had originated in Saxony, Germany. It's a historic center of Lutheranism. From Germany, thousands of Protestant missionaries had gone out to all parts of the world. Patrick Johnson documents in The Future of Global Christianity that from 1900, Germany and Russia, this is countries that are mostly Christian. America, Russia, and Germany, three most Christian countries in terms of numbers. And by 1950, Germany was number two, but now Germany is way down to number nine in terms of the size of Christians. You can see here what's the top evangelical countries. From 1900, America, UK, and Germany. And interesting, 1960, South Africa was number three. Germany is down to number seven. You can see now how Germany and South Africa are far further down on the list. And in fact, you can see what's happening, how Europe is moving more and more secular, and evangelical churches are falling down. Look at the growth of Christianity in marked in the yellow, and when Islam came in, decline, and the growth of Islam at the expense of Christianity, the growth of Christianity during the Crusades, the fall during the bubonic plague, the Black Death, and then growth, but from the time of the First World War, decline of Christianity. Only a growth now, recently, because of the Third World growth. Here you can see the top missionary sending countries. Germany, America, and Britain used to be the three main missionary sending countries back in 1900. Fallen down to eight since, and so on. So the effects on Germany, you can see how they have fallen in many levels spiritually. Where missionaries sent to, where, from where were missionaries sent in the year 2000? Here you can see the cross-cultural missionaries in dark red and missionaries, local missionaries, in the lighter color. You can see the great missionary sending countries. Now it's America, Britain, Germany, India, South Korea. South Africa's on the map. Nigeria is also growing now as a missionary sending country. It was Germany who bore the main brunt of the First World War. Germany was crushed and divided by the outcomes of the world wars. Chiefly the Protestant sections of Germany which were betrayed at the Soviet zone subjected to communist oppression. Millions of Germans were forcibly displaced in the westward movement of Poland's boundary at the end of the Second World War, when literally a massive amount, millions of people's homes were just handed over to the Poles to compensate the Poles for their territory stolen by the Russians, and the Germans were just displaced and forced westwards. Millions of these expellees actually died during those harsh winters. And you can see the difference between the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, where Germany defeated Russia March 1918, and all sat around the table, and Germany insisted on Finland being given independence. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, Georgia, Crimea, all got the independence. This is how the map looked in 1918 because of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And all these countries got their independence as a result of German victory, but Ukraine was betrayed back into the hands of the Soviet Union by the Versailles Treaty. Absolutely wicked. The Versailles Treaty has got to be the worst treaty in history. The British propaganda office achieved its final victory after the war was over. These three all-powerful, all-ignorant men carving continents with only a child to lead them. These are the three men who carved out the world with the Versailles Treaty. They sought to pin all the war guilt exclusively on one country, Germany. And this made possible the extortion of ruinous reparations, which brought about the economic and political collapse of Germany, where 50 million marks couldn't buy a loaf of bread. Before Zimbabwe, this was the worst inflation that had hit the world as a direct result of the Versailles Treaty and the war reparations. And there's much you can say. The Germans not only lost all the overseas territories, their people lost their farms, their properties, their homes in Southwest Africa, Tanganyika, wherever they were, just lost, expropriated without compensation as a result of, and they lost a huge amount of territory as well, leading to a huge amount of resentment and inevitability of a Second World War as a result. So the Versailles Treaty was a catastrophe, and what it did to Austria and Hungary was even worse. Eastern Europe suffered the most. The Versailles Treaty led to the Great Depression. It made the Second World War inevitable. It's not peace, it's an armistice for 20 years, said Marshall Foch. But the effects in Britain, the involvement of predominantly Protestant Britain in two world wars had a disastrous repercussion on Christianity in the realm. Throughout the 19th century, Britain had been the greatest source of missionaries worldwide, the greatest finances of missionaries worldwide. Now you can see the difference between evangelicals in Europe. The darker the red, the less the evangelicals, the lighter the yellow, the higher the percentage of evangelicals. Germany and Britain, the numbers of Protestant church attenders plummeted. Missionary involvement declined dramatically. Both countries suffered shocking secularization. So who benefited from the Great War, the First World War? Many bankers and industrialists amassed stupendous wealth at the expense of the combatants who incurred staggering debts. And that's true today about what's going on in Ukraine. There's some people making a killing. And as somebody said, Biden's philosophy is fight to the last Ukrainian. It's meant to be done for the Ukrainians, but the Ukrainians are the ones suffering the worst. And for no good reason. Those who control the debts control everything. As Mrs. Rothschild said, if my sons did not want war, there would be none. Interesting idea, but the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers have done very well. Well, communism also benefited greatly from the First World War. They got the largest country in the world, Russia. They seized and subjugated all of Russia and in time most of Eastern Europe. The most significant political consequence of the First World War was the revolution that transformed Christian Russia into the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, which chewed up over 50 million of its citizens in over 1,200 concentration camps of the Gulag Archipelago, Arctic hellholes across Siberia, where people ended their lives in misery and torment. Slave labor on a stupendous scale under Stalin in particular. They murdered another 66 million people, including the whole family of the Romanovs, including the four daughters and son of Tsar Nicholas and the Tsarina. Why? This kind of anti-Christian savagery, murdering an entire family. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was once a convinced communist and atheist, but he wrote an unguarded comment in a letter. He's an artillery captain in the Red Army in the First World War, in the Second World War, and he wrote about the Mistoshtvo, which is an irreverent reference to Joseph Stalin. And for that one reference in a private letter, he got sent for 10 years to the concentration camp in the Gulag. It's Alexander Solzhenitsyn who gave us the term the Gulag. And he was converted to Christ in the Gulag. And he became Russia's chief spokesman to expose the horrors of Soviet communism. 49,000 churches in Russia were confiscated or destroyed by the communists. Over 100,000 farms were destroyed in the expropriation without compensation, decolonization. They destroyed the whole culture of Christian Russia, murdered people in the streets. It was horrific. This is the main result of the First World War. It was not a war for Christian civilization and democracy, it was a war against Christian civilization and democracy. And there were revolutions in Hungary, revolutions in Berlin. Communism advanced, farms were destroyed, entire forests burnt down, people starved to death in the decolonization in Ukraine. And as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, you must understand it's wrong to speak about the Russian Revolution. It's the Bolshevik Revolution or the Communist Revolution. It was an anti-Russian revolution. Don't slander the victims by calling it a Russian revolution, he said. They weren't Russians. They hated Russians. They hated Christians. Driven by ethnic hatred, they tortured and slaughtered millions of Russians without a shred of human remorse. More of my countrymen suffered horrific crimes at their bloodstained hands than any people or nation has ever suffered in the entirety of human history. It cannot be overstated. Bolshevism committed the greatest human slaughter of all time. The fact that most of the world is ignorant and uncaring about this enormous crime is proof that the global media is in the hands of the perpetrators. He said this in Harvard in 1978, which destroyed his credibility in the West. He was so popular as a refusnik, dissident, exile from Russia, great Nobel Literature Award winner. But at Harvard University, he said, behind the Iron Curtain, our media speaks with one voice. But we're not surprised because we only have one political party in charge and they control the media. But now I'm in the West, the free democratic West, and here your media also speaks with one voice. It's the same voice I heard behind the Iron Curtain. Who controls the media in the West? Well, at this point, it's like Solzhenitsyn was strength for Putin, under no circumstance could you quote from him. And it's like he died. He didn't. But they wouldn't quote from him for the next several decades. That was the hatred. Alexander Solzhenitsyn declared, "The world has never before known a godlessness as organized, militarized, and tenaciously malevolent as that preached by Marxism. Within the philosophical system of Marx and Lenin, and at the heart of their psychology, hatred of God is the principal driving force, more fundamental than all their political and economic pretensions. A militant atheism is not merely incidental or marginal to communist policy, it is not a side effect, but the central pivot." Bela Kun, who took over Hungary and killed hundreds of thousands of people in a few months that he had it before he was overthrown. Revolutionaries tried to take Berlin, also in 1919, and Spartacus revolutionaries tried to take Bavaria, and there was civil war in the streets in Germany, and you kind of understand how extremists come to power when you have a collapse, which is one of the results of world wars like this. Stalin also said, it's not who votes who counts, it's who counts the votes. Which is awfully relevant in this day after the 2020 free and fair elections in America. Here you can see how there was no communist country before 1917. But from the First World War grew communism. And then the Second World War expanded even further. The Cold War even further until 1989. And the wall came down. But in the meantime, how many people, more than 100 million, killed in those communist countries as a result of what started in the First World War? 1900, you can see the red shows where most of the people are secular or non-religious. 1950, 2000, projected to 2050, the world's getting more secular, at least in the Northern Hemisphere and Australia. And so you can see how there has been in Europe a decline of Christianity since 1950, dramatic decline. And again, you can see the religions all over, but Europe, unfortunately, has a very large amount of convinced atheists. And this is how it was in 1900. Evangelicals, strongest in Northern Europe, especially Britain, Scandinavian countries and Germany. Today, evangelicals are a much lower percentage. And this, just to remind us how Christian Europe used to be. Graveyards filled with crosses. So in the wake of the First World War, many came to speak of a post-Christian world. As wars and revolutions threw the entire world into disorder, pessimists and critics predicted the imminent departure of Christianity. Yet against all odds, despite it being dealt what seemed like a death blow in its heartland, Protestant Christians showed remarkable vitality. Now these things became examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as were some of them. Now all these things happened to them as examples and they're written for our admonition. History can tell us a lot. As God's covenant people had overcome the Roman Empire and the barbarian and Viking invasions and the Arab invasions, the onslaught of the Mongol Empire and the bubonic plague, and survived invasions of the Turks and upheavals of the French Revolution, Christians have adapted and overcome, even in Europe. And Christianity has experienced dramatic growth in Africa, the Americas, and Asia. Even in Eastern Europe, in some of the most unexpected places, behind the Iron Curtain, churches multiplied, faith deepened, despite the most relentless anti-Christian persecution by communist governments, and the Berlin Wall did come down, and the Iron Curtain was collapsed. And we have seen a resurgence of Christianity, especially in Ukraine and Russia, two of the largest Christian countries in Europe. There's more evangelical born-again Christians in Ukraine and Russia than any other parts of Europe. Ukraine, Russia, and Romania have the three largest Christian populations in Europe today, which is why it's so tragic to see again, on a smaller scale, Christians being mobilized to fight one another. It's tragic. It's unnecessary. These are unnecessary wars. Jesus Christ taught, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." It's essential that we learn the truths of history to recognize the lies of propaganda. We need to study the Word of God so we can be freed from deception. I heard it many a time from my dad and others who fought in the Second World War. If we could have known what would become of our countries, we wouldn't have fought against each other. We would have fought together side by side. The next time we fight it side by side. And that was the spirit in Europe. So how you have Europe now dividing and getting ready to fight one another again just seems to me so tragic. Have they not learned from the history of the 20th century? We're going to have this presentation, audio video, up on our frontlinemissionsa.org audio and video sites. Over the years, I've given many different presentations on different First World War presentations and incorporating lessons learned from these different books. And you can find on our website many articles tackling these issues. This is an interesting title, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War. It's like they sleepwalked into war. And it looks like it's been done again in our time. People are literally talking. There's even a general in Britain telling the general population, we must be ready for this war lasting another 10 years. And Britain's got to prepare. The British Army and population has to prepare for a world war. Now, there's talk like this all over the place. American TV people and government people talk about the need for nuclear war with Russia. I mean, are they insane? And that's why we need to learn from people like Herbert Hoover, who exposed the treachery and the lies behind the Second World War, and understanding the secret war and all the lies that were told about that in the past, to understand how we've been lied to again today. So these are just some books that I have imbibed and some of the presentations that have been given before, which you can find on our sermon audio and on our Frontline web on the different lectures on wars in the past and these geostrategic issues. So, any questions, any comments, complaints or criticisms? Yes, Brian.
I read in the Daily Express UK, there's a general who's been put in charge of the entire military complex. He's now, you know, the head man there. And he was saying that, you know, we've got to get ourselves organized to fight a war in Europe. And the Russian response was that, you know, if there was a war, they would obliterate the British Isles completely. So I personally, I mean, for what it's worth, I don't believe there will be this great war. But what I think is happening is, like with the COVID pandemic, or you're talking about financial collapse, or you're talking about climate change, it's the same thing, it's fear. Because they want to herd these people into their world order. Because only a world order government can stop these wars, can stop climate change, can make sure that we don't, you know, all die of some of them in plague or something like that. So there's a lot of things behind the scenes. It's not a, we are not heading for a nuclear war. There will not be a nuclear war.
But they want us to be afraid of it.
They want us to be terrified of it. And I think that obviously it will work with a lot of people, unfortunately.
Yes. Now, I think, let's face it, a lot of this is to terrify people. And even the obsession that you get with movies these days trying to suggest aliens invading us, I mean, really and truly. And that justifies, well, you need some big global massive force to defend us from aliens. Well, the biggest threat's actually from our own governments these days. But it's nice to distract people. I think a lot of these things are distractions, while the government takes more powers. Any other questions, comments?
So I've been in sort of Omna's sort of regional battle where we see the sovereignty of God. So sort of sometimes you sort of get this view that all these secret societies or whatever is trying to get us to get into war, but then some things you read in the Bible, that God sort of the sovereignty of God, how do we get to the point where, well, this is kind of supposed to be, because also one, this is just sinful men doing what sinful men do, and God judging people, and also kind of reminding us that this is a fallen world, this will always happen, that there's sort of no way to, we will get to a utopia where this could never happen again. So I'm just sort of thinking that things are happening, but this is the
world. Well, as Christians, we've got to learn from these things. We can certainly see depravity of man involved in this. And like Psalm 2, why do the nations rage? Why do the kings of the earth conspire together against the Lord and against his anointed? And you can see a lot of this is conspiracy against God and against God's people. And we've gone from over a century ago where Christians ruled the world to where Christians are being persecuted by their own governments. I mean, even in Britain, you can get into trouble wearing a cross. You're not allowed to wear a cross in British Airways and things like, you know, just insane. Firing their own staff for being Christians. A person, a medical doctor losing his job because he doesn't want to do an abortion or he advises his patient using scripture. The amount of anti-Christian prejudice that's coming out from the American and British governments, for example, just shows how things have changed. And now with the homosexual lobby gets exalted and Christianity gets debased, it's bizarre. So we can still say with Joseph, Genesis 50 verse 20, what you meant for evil, God will use for good. And God can work all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So we know that. But we're meant to be learning from history. I mean, as from the passage in 1 Corinthians 10, that these things are written for our admonition, that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So we've got to learn from history, biblical history first and foremost. And a lot of biblical history is about wicked kings and wicked people, and we're meant to learn from this. And it also means we've got to do a better job of preaching against sin, preaching the gospel, calling people to repentance and discipleship. Because if there had been better discernment, you wouldn't have seen Christians so enthusiastically running out and killing one another. And that's why when we've shown about the Christmas truce, that at Christmas on the Eastern and Western fronts, hundreds of thousands of troops just laid down their weapons and came out and sang Christmas carols and celebrated with one another and had worship service together and played football and exchanged ration packs. And they saw the other side were also Christian. And at this point, there was such a resistance against going back to fight, and they were firing high, and they were warning one another about artillery barrage that had been planned in the area and coming to our trenches and swapping them. And this was happening across the board, except on a Serbian front. The Serbs never observed it. But the Russians, the Austrians, the Germans, the French, the Belgians, the Germans, they all observed the Christmas truce. So this just showed again that there was still a real basic Christianity there. And the high-ups went berserk. They tried hundreds of French soldiers for mutiny because they'd fraternized their enemy. The British were court-martialing officers who were meant to be shot because they had fraternized their enemy and did all sorts of that. And then they found they couldn't get these men to fight one another again. They had to ship them to entirely different fronts, had to take men from the Western Front and send them to fight the Ottoman Empire and bring other people in. And the Germans had to take whole units from the Western Front, ship them to the Eastern Front because they no longer were willing to aim to actually shoot the people on the other side because they'd celebrate Christmas together. And this just shows again that, and I know it's so on the ground in Ukraine right now. I've got friends on both sides. Christian Russians, Christian Ukrainians, missionaries from South Africa and from America in Ukraine and in Russia. And the people on the ground are generally well-meaning people without malice towards their neighbors. But there's conniving politicians and military-industrial complex creeps who are manipulating this. And it's wicked. And it would have been so much better if they had had a sort of like, we're going home. Imagine if after Christmas truce, everyone just decided, that's it. We're not fighting a war. And there was one of the longest surviving Tommy from the First World War. He died just a few years ago. He was a young man in the First World War, and he got quite angry talking about how the British politicians wheel him out on the 11th of November, literally wheel him out, to promote their new wars in Iraq and so on. And he said, I want nothing to do this. He said, I must tell you, I never shot anyone in the First World War. I did my duty. I was there. They forced us to be there, but a whole lot of my men, we decided we would never aim at another human being. We'd stand there. We would fire when we were told to, but we would aim high and we'd never intentionally harm someone on the other side. So if we didn't want to be dehumanized, don't you try and use me to promote your worthless wars in Iraq and so on. And I just forget his name for a moment, but he's a very famous chap. He's the last surviving British infantryman from the First World War. And he said, you know, and he humiliated the British Prime Minister at that time. Who was that one in the 1990s? At any rate, He was this warmonger who was promoting war crimes in Iraq at that time anyway. And so this British Prime Minister got really humiliated in public by this First World War veteran who he was trying to use to promote his agenda. And this is the thing, a lot of the soldiers on the ground are really furious over what they're being used for. And the people who go to these wars, I mean, just think, for 20 years, American soldiers fighting in Afghanistan. For what? And at the end, they hand over $80 billion worth of weapons to the Taliban terrorists that they're meant to be fighting for, against. The entire Russian military budget for the year is $50 billion. They gave $80 billion to the Afghan terrorists.
And that airport that's a world-class military base.
Yes.
Handed over top
weapon.
An easy launching pad into China. I mean, that was also a stress.
Better that they even went there. And this is the point, in many cases, you look at most of the wars of the 20th century, and I'm no pacifist. I believe there's a time to fight. And I've been involved in a few wars, and I've certainly supported the war for southern Sudan's independence and defending South Africa on the border of Angola and so on. But most of the wars of the 20th century have left the countries much worse than they were before. Much, much, much worse. Especially the wars America's got involved in. I mean, try and find a country that's better off now than it was before they came and bombed it. And so this way, and the trouble is, there's what they call the neocons in America today, who neoconservatives who support every war. I've been there. I remember in 2014, when they were all talking about, you know, don't you agree we should be bombing Syria? And I said, no, you shouldn't be bombing Syria. Syria's got 6% Christians. In fact, a huge percentage of the army is Christian because they know the only thing standing between them and ISIS chopping their heads off is Assad's secular government that gives religious freedom to the people in Syria. Why would you want to destabilize one of the few countries in the Middle East that actually has effective religious freedom for the population? Why are you on the same side as ISIS? And these, I even asked several of these people, can you find Syria on the map? I mean, they're happy to bomb countries even though they can't find them on the map. And the mentality of those people, and these are not leftist liberals, these are conservatives, Christians even, who just are so stirred up by the media into supporting any war. Doesn't matter who it is, where it is, and what the issue is, they support the idea of bombing people somewhere else. And I remember many a time I've had this argument in America where friends have been saying, you know, the Muslims hate us because we're free. And I said, oh, that's a lot of nonsense. Nobody hates Syria. I mean, nobody hates Switzerland. Switzerland's free. They're freer than you are. They hate you because you bomb them. Stop bombing people and they'll probably not hate you so much. And many Americans are oblivious to the idea that they're causing enormous amounts of suffering for people in other countries. And they think they're always the good guys. Well, that's not the way the average person sees on the ground. And you think of what people think, like in Afghanistan, is that the Americans are coming in there and pushing LGBTQ, flying the gay pride flag. What do you think the average Muslim thinks of that? Just, it couldn't be more counterproductive unless it had been planned that way. So I just wish some people learned from these things. This is interesting. In Sarajevo today, you go and they've got a museum on the street corner where it began, which I suppose is good. You might as well turn a bad thing into a place we can learn something. But I get the impression that Sarajevo is a bit proud of it, which is sad because it's a disgrace. And it's still appropriate to have a museum there, but the street corner that started the 20th century. Well, one of the key things to remember is the 20th century has been the worst century in history for the Christian church in terms of martyrs. More Christians have been martyred in the 20th century than the previous 19 centuries combined. Now, on the other side, the church has had tremendous growth, but this has not been as good a growth as the 19th century. Because while it's been growth in numbers, it hasn't been the same depth of impact that the 19th century missionary movement had. Now, I'm an optimist. I'm post-millennial. I would like to believe that the 21st century will be the greatest century of missionary advance and of revival. But we've got to learn the lessons. We can't keep redoing the mess of the 20th century. We need to go back and learn from the 19th century, which was far more productive, effective, and saved lives. The 20th century has been hideous for freedom, and it's been awful for what it's done to the church. Nevertheless, even where the persecution has been severe, the church has succeeded, in such as in Russia, in winning the country. But the trouble is, when you look at Europe, what do you see? The strongest places spiritually are Eastern Europe. So violent communist persecution and atheist indoctrination was less effective in destroying the church than the Western materialism, evolutionism, and the seduction of Hollywood and all of that has done more damage spiritually than even communist terrorism, which is hard to imagine. I don't want to minimize the damage done by communism. But can you see the battle we're in? Right now, NATO is no longer defending the free world. NATO is galvanizing and provoking for a world war, which is insane. I've had people from Eastern Europe say to me, NATO today looks like the Warsaw Pact used to be back in the 80s. Which is how things change. Right now, there's more Christianity in Moscow than there is in New York and Washington. Just bizarre. For half of my life, the Russians were the biggest enemy that we were fighting. And now they're some of our friends, and they're some of our hope of one of the few countries that's got some Christian standards. And remember, people are hating Putin, not because he used to be KGB, but mostly because he's now not LGBTQ, and he's against the homosexual agenda and abortion agenda for strong families and things like that. Basically, Russia now represents nationalism, and NATO and the West are representing internationalism, globalism. And that's the kind of fight right now. And this is a war of proxy. What's going on in Ukraine right now is a war of proxy between NATO and Russia, and Ukraine's a battlefield. And Ukraine, one might also say, it's one of the most corrupt governments on the planet. Very corrupt government. And Zelensky's no Democrat. He's banned 11 of the 12 political parties. He's confiscated their property, seized their assets. He's banned every media outlet except government-controlled ones. He's locked up journalists and opposition members of parliament. Even before the war, he's doing that. So Ukraine's not a paragon of democracy. In fact, most of the trafficked women in the world come from Ukraine and Moldova. It's leader in the world of human trafficking, and it's also one of the leaders in the world of corruption on many levels and of biological warfare laboratories. So, not that the poor Ukrainian people deserve any of this that's being done to them. That's shocking and unacceptable, but this is something that's been provoked, and globalists wanted this war. And I don't think the Ukrainian people or the Russian people want this war, but this is what globalists are pushing on them. I must say, at this time, I really feel for those people, but seldom has it seemed more convenient to be living in the Southern Hemisphere.